is Gordon versus Gordon. Mr. Blackburn, Mr. Powers. Have you signed in?
Yes.
Great.
Yes.
Wonderful. Okay. Mr. Blackburn, good to see you. You have 15 minutes. Would you care to reserve any time for rebuttal?
5, if I could, Judge.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
Thank you, Judge.
Whenever you're ready.
Yes, ma'am. If you're honest, please, good morning. I'm Joe Blackburn, and I'm representing George Gordon here in this divorce case. George and Beth Gordon were married for 28 years. They were frugal people. They lived in a house over in Chesterfield that was worth $292,000. They had a marital estate of $4.5 million when they divorced. They had one real luxury. They sent their son to collegiate school. But other than that, they were frugal. She used the word frugal in her testimony. The court divided all of the marital assets 50-50. And in that division, Mrs. Gordon received half of a $2.6 million investment account. She got $1.3 million of that. And that account, the year ending 5 months before we tried this case, that account had earned $96,000 in it by way of income. The expectations would be then that she would get half of that $96,000 as her income off of that investment account.
Counsel, let me interrupt you for
just
a moment, sir. Your contention is that the judge abused his discretion in the award of spousal support in part because of the equitable distribution award that the appellee received. Is that correct?
I think that's our best argument for reversal. I think he also abused it as to not imputing income to her, but
okay,
I certainly
sure.
think that aspect.
But with that aspect, aren't those really separate inquiries? The division of property under the equitable distribution and the factors considered under spousal support for spousal support?
Well, they are separate inquiries, but the code says that the court shall establish spousal support once it equitably distributes the marital property.
Right.
So then thereafter, it can see what financial resources are available for spousal support.
Well, in Getz versus Getz, we drew the distinction and said as follows. Spousal support involves a legal duty flowing from one spouse to the other by virtue of the marital relationship. By contrast, the monetary award does not flow from any legal duty, but involves an adjustment of the equities, rights, and interests of the parties in marital property. So as Judge O'Brien just said, it's like apples and oranges. And it seems to me to, in most cases where the wife has not worked, but was a partner in the marriage and is equally entitled to share in the marital estate, to in effect penalize her by using that to offset a spousal support award, which is based on different factors, by its very nature seems inequitable to me, and or at least it seemed that way to the trial court, I gather.
Well, it must have, and the trial court used the words thinking it was a wash since he was getting a like amount that she was. It wouldn't be equitable to have her have to look to income off of her investments and him not to. Of course, the argument against that is he was working, and that's the reason that he didn't have to do it. But back to your point, the code does say that, as we know, that the court does not set permanent spousal support until it looks at what the equitable distribution was. And in the Roe case that I cited in my brief, this court sent the case back, as Mr. Powers argued in his brief, for other reasons. But the other reasons were that the court had committed error, the trial court had committed error in how it equitably distributed the property. So this court then said, well, since that's going back, you've got to send the spousal support issue back too, because the court has to look at the ultimate equitable distribution that happens. So the bottom line is she still is getting income off of those assets. I think it was error to say it was a wash. It might have been, let's suppose the trial court had said, well, I'm going to assume she's going to have $48,000 in income. I'm going to use that as her income before I determine spousal support and add that on to his income, and then make a determination as to what the need is.
But is the circuit court required to do any more than consider that as one factor?
Well, the circuit court has to consider all of the factors and certainly can give what weight it wants to any of the factors.
Well, I ask because your argument on brief is that the circuit court did not consider that. But I'm looking at the letter of opinion, it seems that it did. It didn't do what you wanted it to do, but it certainly seemed to have considered it.
Well, it certainly considered it, but I think it has to do more than just consider it. In this court, you said in the Schultz case, a trial court by definition abuses its discretion when it makes an error of law. I think it's an error of law if you read the code and then read what this court said in the Roe case. In the Roe case, you said the income has to be considered, and to have evidence that she's going to have $48,000 a year in income coming off of her investment.
But would you agree that our review is not a de novo review? We don't just plug what we would do into the equation here. It's an abuse of discretion standard.
It is an abuse of discretion, but I would argue that. As you said in the Schultz case, if by definition an abuse of discretion is when it makes an error in law, and I think it's an error in law if the Code of Virginia says, Judge, you've got to consider the spousal support after you consider equitable distribution.
But you don't just consider equitable distribution. Assuming you do consider equitable distribution, you also consider earning capacity, financial obligations, needs based on, I guess, what they're used to, the standard of living they're used to, and then any property interests the parties have. I think we said that in Getz.
Yes.
So if the court is required to consider all of those things, but isn't required to quantify what percentage of each factor what weighs in on its decision, it's just as required to consider all of those things. You seem to be arguing that the marital property distribution weighs more heavily or almost exclusively here, I guess, than any other factor.
Well, my argument is very simply this. When the code says you order the spousal support after you equitably distribute property, this court interprets what code sections require and what they mean. And when you say in Roe, when determining spousal support, the trial court must consider the income generating potential of the marital ward.
But consider is just that. Consider. And if the judge considers it, how do we say it's an abuse of discretion?
But he threw it out. If his finding would have been, okay, I'm going to consider, it's a undisputed fact, that she is going to have $4,000 a month in income. I'm going to consider that. I'll consider that he's getting an extra $4,000 a month and then set the spousal support. I'd have a tougher road to hoe. What I would be doing is coming down here and saying, he gave her $16,000 in effect in support when he found she only needed $6,000.
But Mr. Blackburn, I have a couple of factual questions I want to ask you. Where in the record does it reflect that what she earned to be a volleyball coach?
I don't think it does.
Okay. What about the investment accounts in the IRA?
The investment account earning, I would have to, I think I've referenced that in my,
the potential investment income?
There was testimony and there was an exhibit that showed the income, the December...
The potential income?
Right. Well, it showed the actual income that the account earned December 31 of the year ending 5 months before we tried the case. There was an exhibit that showed that at $96,000+.
Okay.
So.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think my only other argument I said was that I thought the court should have imputed income, and if I am fortunate enough to have you remanded, I hope that will be part of the direction to the trial court. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. In police report, I'm Charles Powers, represent Beth Gordon. Judge, I think it's Exhibit 34, it's on appendix page 195, and that was an expert, the expert evidence that was introduced by Mr. Gordon. Their argument on brief is that evidence was unrebutted, and basically the saying the court was required to accept that. I argued on brief and that it was not unrebutted. The cross-examination of the expert undercut what those figures showed. They conceded that they didn't have enough information to actually determine an after-tax value, didn't know how much support Ms. Gordon would receive. So, yes, that is part of the evidence. I think that's where there was discussion about what could come. But going back to what Judge Humphreys referenced, you have to consider all of the statutory factors. In fact, with Miller versus Cox, Judge Humphreys was on that panel, and one of the rulings in that specific case is the court must consider all factors, not required to quantify the weight given to each individual factor. That was citing the Woolley case, and that's been around for many, many years. So bottom line is, yes, you have to the court has to consider all statutory factors, doesn't have to sit down and go and give a complete findings of fact, conclusions of law, to say this is exactly how I considered, this is why I came up with this exact dollar amount. So with respect to the consideration of equitable distribution, I believe the court did consider it, it did talk about it, did go through the factors, and then considered the remaining factors and came up with a legitimate, we believe, reasonable amount of spousal support based on the discretion given to the court.
Mr. Parris, did the circuit court rely on Muth's testimony about the wife's tax obligations?
You know, off the top of my head, I don't recall. I know part of his testimony wasn't considered by the court. Some of it was considered. I don't remember where the distinction was, but if he offered the testimony with respect to the tax consequences, that was part of what was considered by the court. Whatever expert testified, I think Mr. Gordon's argument on brief has been that has to be accepted by the trial court. And an expert testimony, and there's plenty of cases that say that an expert's testimony is not required. The court has to weigh the evidence. Every reasonable inference is given to the trial court who saw the experts testify, who saw Mr. Muth testify, who saw what was presented in court and saw all the evidence, and weigh, determine how to consider that evidence. So any tax effect would be, again, just one of the factors. That is one of the factors is tax effects of spousal support of anything. So that's one of the things the court would consider.
And which party bore the burden of proving your client's future investment income?
I believe it would be Mr. Gordon because he's a legend. He's trying to impute income to her or say that you, Ms. Gordon, have this specific earning capacity under one of the statutory factors. So he needs to prove that point. He's the one that's asking the trial court to do that, so it's his burden to prove that point. So I still believe, and I assert the trial court did consider equitable distribution, did consider the statutory factors. There wasn't much argument presented here as to the imputation of income, but I do not believe that imputation, again, is required. The trial court listened to the evidence, looked at what was presented, and determined that it was not appropriate. At this point, you know, processes are slow and chances are small that she will have substantial earnings in the next few years, and that sounds consistent with what the evidence that was presented.
Can I ask you, you've requested attorney's fees on appeal. Can I ask you what you think justifies in this case?
Judge, there's minimal case law on awarding attorney's fees. But in the cases that
do... Can you throw it out there?
No. But the cases that do talk about that, it's the arguments that are being presented here supported by the law, and I do not believe they are. This is clearly a discretion case, and what Mr. Gordon is arguing here on appeal is that there is, you know, this is just an abuse of discretion. When the discretion is so vast to the trial court, it has to be reasonable minds must differ. There's no allegation that what a reasonable mind, what a reasonable jurist would have done or should have done. So first of all, it's an argument not supported by law, and I don't think it's fairly debatable. I think that's one of the other key factors this court looks at in determining attorney's fees. Was this issue fairly debatable? And I submit that it's not. If you have any further questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Otherwise, thank you for your time this morning. We ask that you affirm the award. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Blackburn, you got a little over, just under 5 minutes.
Thank you. Your Honor, to answer your question, it's on page 290 of the in the appendix, shows a $96,369 in income generated off of their investment account at Wells Fargo Advisors. I would also point out that her expert, if you look at page, did I say 290 or 390? It's on 290.
You said 290.
And then on page 298, there's her expert's chart where even her expert assumed interest and dividend in income to her of almost $34,000. Let me say this. I certainly understand that a trial court doesn't have to accept the testimony at all of an expert if it doesn't want to. Mr. Muth testified that if she withdrew income and principal from what she was getting, actually less than what she ultimately got, that she could withdraw $65,000 a year till she was 95 years old. And at 95 years old, there wouldn't be any more money. And I understand this court has said you don't have to invade principal when it comes to considering the income that's available to a party. But it wasn't expert testimony. It was simply fact that in the year ending right before the trial, this account earned $96,000, and I certainly think that is reason to assume that she's going to get a good chunk of money off of that account every year in the future without invading her principal. And I think if we look at the law coupled with your decision in the Roe case, he should have put that income in her column and then determined her need.
Mr. Blackburn, did you object to Muth's testimony about the wife's tax obligations below? Did you object in the trial court to that?
Well, Muth was... I don't think I did.
Okay, so doesn't that create a problem?
Well, there's certainly a tax obligation that should be considered. I mean, the court found, as I put in my argument in my brief, the court found Mr. Gordon did a pro forma that found that he said her need was $5,800, and the judge made a finding of fact. After he looked at all of her testimony and all of her exhibits, he made a finding of fact that was approximately correct, that her need was $5,800. But his point and mine was it did not include the tax amount that would be, and the judge just said $12,000. I think to say $12,000 when you're getting another, when her need is $5,800, she's going to get $4,000 a month in income and dividends, and she's going to get another $12,000 on top of that. That's way beyond need. I would ask you to reverse it.
Thanks, sir.
Thank you.
We'll come down.